It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back next week. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll put a historical twist on Food Friday with a look at the development of what might be America's most iconic spirit, bourbon. First, though, the UW System's smallest four-year college, UW-Superior, is grappling with a $2.5 million structural deficit. The chancellor of the school announced yesterday that they're suspending or cutting 15 programs, including almost half of the graduate studies at the school, among other cost-cutting measures. WPR reporter Mike Simonson is based in Superior. He joins us now from our studio there. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what kind of programs are they talking about cutting there?
Well, they're looking at visual arts programs. Art education would be cut. And these are master's programs, mass media, and reading specialist, library science. In all, it's 12, and I got my figures wrong, it's 12 of 25 graduate programs. And that's the stuff that has to do with the academic side of things. On the other side of things, they're looking at outsourcing, privatizing pretty much everything that isn't academic, like campus security. IT. They're already outsourcing the bookstore. That'll kick in July, and Westman Arena, which is their sports arena, that will be privatized by the end of this year. So it's, they're looking at custodial grounds crews, just about anything and everything.
We'll dig a little deeper into those changes, but first, you know, on some campuses, $2.5 million on a larger campus might not be a huge amount. What does that mean in the scope of a school the size of UW-Superior?
Well, UW-Superior is unique, although there are other campuses that are also showing fund balances that are shrinking rather alarmingly fast, and that's from a large school, UW-Milwaukee, and then the smaller Parkside, Stout, as well as Superior. Their fund balance is Superior's in the negative. The others are shrinking fast. But you're right, the full-time, about 2,500 students are on campus here, so that's a drop in the bucket to the larger campuses like Madison. So any kind of cut like that will have more impact on a small budget.
What is the administration of UW-Superior chalking up the shortfall to?
They call it the nexus of tuition freeze, legislative cuts over the past 4 years, but also there's some debt servicers, some nice new buildings up here, but they're paying off on the debt, and some of the promised donations for paying for it haven't come through, so they're carrying more debt service. And then a rather cryptic decisions that should have been made a few years ago weren't made, and now UW-Superior is paying for that. But, you know, this is something that a lot of universities, I think the entire system, is watching very closely to see how this handles, because the consequences of the legislative action and the tuition freeze may be first felt here at such a small campus.
But that legislative action and the tuition freeze were in part in response to what was perceived anyway as too high a reserve fund around the UW system. The university might want that reserve fund in case of something like this, so it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, the critics, mostly the Republican legislators, were saying that, hey, these are pots of money, and it did exceed $1 billion at one point. It no longer is that. So that was, what are you guys doing with all this cash hanging around? But really, the UW system says that this cash has always been designated. It wasn't just sitting around. And in some cases, like the smaller campuses I mentioned, they didn't have those pots of money, those reserves that really are making First UW-Superior look at some really drastic changes.
Well, and you mentioned the idea of outsourcing. Is this the first at a UW campus?
At a four-year campus, UW-Marathon has done some outsourcing. That's a two-year campus, and perhaps others have, but this is the first time a four-year campus is doing things like custodians, grounds crew, and they haven't made any final decisions up here yet on that, but they did send all the 26 grounds and custodians at-risk letters saying that they could be laid off in 2 weeks, and I tell you what, you talk to a custodian around here right now, and everybody is very, very down in the mouth.
And you sent us a clip with some of the, I think, union response to the outsourcing. Let's give a listen.
You call, they come. Whether it's a flood, whether it's a broken basketball hoop, they know that stuff. And that's what we need, people who know and people who care about the community, and they are the community.
So talking about the institutional memory of the people who are being laid off here.
Right. A lot of these men and women have been on this job and know all for 10, 20, 30 years. They know all the nooks and crannies, but they also have relationships with faculty and with students. As one custodian said, look, if a student needs directions to get someplace, I won't give them the directions. I will take them to that place until they feel comfortable on the campus.
On the union side of this, do they have any room to negotiate here?
No, not with Act 10, which really took a lot of the negotiating power, almost all the negotiating power from the public unions. What they're trying to do is advise the workers what their options are. But really, except for them forming companies to bid for privatization jobs on the UW Superior campus, there isn't a whole lot they can do except perhaps exert public pressure.
You mentioned that other UW system schools will be watching, in part because of the impact of the tuition freeze. Are they going to be watching and taking notes on how outsourcing goes over and how much money is saved?
I think so. There are faculty members here who are not at risk, but they're putting up signs, you know, save our custodians, save our ground crews. It's something that is endemic as part of the university community, and so they're rallying around it. And I heard on a Joy's show somebody call up a few days ago and say, look what's happening at UW Superior, watch that.
And one change that was floated and then taken back, the theater program evidently was going to be suspended. That's being reconsidered. What happened there?
Well, I'm not sure, but Chancellor Wachter said, told the communicating arts faculty on Monday that theater is suspended, theater's canceled. And 2 days later, she changed her mind, backpedaled on it. And I asked her about that yesterday, and she says, well, let's just say some alumni stepped forward. So I think the heat was on for that decision because theater is such an outreach thing. It is such a part of the community. Even though the enrollment is small for theater, a lot of people get enjoyment out of it and look forward to that. And it really wouldn't have saved much money. So, that's all part of the political pressure thing, though. Do custodians have that kind of political pressure that perhaps alum have or, you know, a theater program has?
So long term, is there concern about what the impact's going to be here on UW-Superior's image, ability to attract students from around the state and beyond?
Well, some people are going to say, hey, you know, you got to cut, you got to cut, you got to economize, you got to look at things, you got to change with the times. And other people are going to say, maybe we need to talk to our legislators and change priorities. The legislature made the technical colleges a larger priority and increased funding so they can work with programs to link with private sector jobs. And perhaps that's going to be part of the UW system change, too, is to become more and more relevant. But in the meantime, what happens up here could have a ripple effect on the whole system.
And Mike, can you leave us a sense of how important the UW-Superior campus is as part of the Superior community as a whole?
It is everything. I mean, shipping, of course, the port is very important, but culturally speaking, educationally speaking, and a lot of people work here too. It's just a place where the hometown kid can go to school and learn. It's a point of pride, and they even have a pretty good hockey team.
All right, Mike, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
I've been speaking with Superior-based WPR reporter Mike Simonson. He's updating us on a program on program cuts at UW-Superior announced yesterday. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today on Food Friday, we've got a historical twist. The history of one of America's most iconic foods, beverages really, is uniquely intertwined with American history itself. According to our guest, the beverage is bourbon. Well, the name may sound, a bit French, the Bourbon Dynasty there. there's not much French about it. Probably the most closely associated with the American frontier, Kentucky in particular, the corn-based barrel-aged spirit is American all the way. Well, we've got Dane Hucklebridge with us now. He's got a new book out on bourbon. It's called Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. Dane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it was fascinating to read in your book, early colonial days, all the hardships, far from home, and one of the main complaints colonists had was, we don't have good booze here. And that's what led them to turn corn into alcohol in the first place. What were some of the first steps there?
Sure. Well, I mean, what you had was, in those very early colonial days, the first English settlers, they really did not like to drink water. And, you know, with good reason, in hindsight, they thought it was poisonous. And it was because so often, you know, people would drink from polluted water sources and get sick from it. So they, in that period in time amongst Englishmen, they really avoided water as a drink. So as a substitute, they drank lots of alcoholic beverages, both higher in alcohol and lower in alcohol. The problem being, when they came to Virginia, suddenly that was a really long beer run crossing the Atlantic. So they had to figure out a way to start producing their own alcoholic beverages locally. And that's really, you know, since they didn't really have that much barley and it didn't grow well, they started like looking into making alcohol from native grains, one of which was corn. And that's really those very early days in Virginia when you first start seeing alcohol being made from corn, which is the basis of bourbon whiskey.
So 1620 or so is where you attribute the birth of bourbon. Some purists disagree. Would a modern-day bourbon drinker tasting that early corn alcohol recognize it as bourbon?
Well, probably not, because under most circumstances it would not have been aged. I mean, if it would have been aged back then, it probably would have happened so by accident. So if it just so happened that you had some very early colonial whiskey that had been forgotten about or left to sit for and spend some time in a barrel, then in that case, I think it's possible it would be recognizable as something, if not bourbon, relatively close. But for most of that period, they weren't really aging their whiskey. It would have been consumed, you know, almost immediately when it's still clear right out of the still.
These guys couldn't wait.
Yeah, they just couldn't wait. It was a hard life. They needed a drink, I guess.
Now, they weren't calling it bourbon then. Where and when did that name come about?
Sure. Well, as you know, I mean, bourbon, it comes from Bourbon, Kentucky, this region. And today, you know, Bourbon County is a very small county, and they don't even make any whiskey there, to my knowledge. But once upon a time, it was much larger. And there was a whole big region of sort of central and eastern Kentucky that was referred to as the Bourbon Region or Bourbon County. And that took its name from, you know, the Bourbon Dynasty from France. And right after the Revolution, when all of that land was opening up for settlement, people had a lot of gratitude to the French for helping us win the war with England. So you see a lot of French names in that area, one of which is this Bourbon County, this Bourbon region, and they started making corn whiskey. And probably, you know, they first started making the whiskey in the late 1700s. I think the first real mention of it in print anyway, being called bourbon whiskey, is 1820. That was around there anyway. That was a little bit of an anomaly. But by the 1840s, 1850s, the name has definitely caught on. And by the time of the Civil War, you know, this bourbon whiskey was known both north and south throughout America.
And by the end of the Civil War, it was popular enough that people were making fake bourbon or selling not bourbon as bourbon. And it ended up causing a major scandal in American politics. Tell us about that.
Indeed. Well, you know, that area, that time after the Civil War, the Gilded Age, was just beset by all manner of corporate greed and corruption. And, you know, the whiskey was not exempt. There was quite a bit of corruption in whiskey, both literally in that a lot of distilleries outside of Kentucky in particular were turning out very low quality sort of fake whiskey, fake bourbon, and trying to sell it as bourbon. But also, even, you know, the bigger scope, there was a lot of government corruption. There was the whiskey ring I mentioned in the book. There was this. So basically, the distillers, some of these unscrupulous distillers and politicians, were in cahoots, and they weren't paying the taxes they should have been on this low-quality bourbon, and, you know, they weren't reporting it, and they were bribing the government officials. And this scandal ended up going all the way, you know, all the way to the White House, potentially all the way up to Grant, and that's it was a big kind of black eye for America and the whiskey industry.
And moving ahead to the 1890s, another war, not really a literal war, I don't think, a whiskey war, mainly in Kentucky, between established producers and others. What was the whiskey war, and what was the outcome?
Well, in a way, yeah, that was a direct offshoot of what I mentioned. You had the more traditional bourbon distilleries in Kentucky who still made their product, you know, purely from their mash bill, their corn, aged it in charred oak barrels and let it sit there for through the years and turned out, you know, a more high quality, authentic product. And then scattered mostly outside Kentucky in a lot in cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati and New Orleans as well. You had other distillers who were essentially just trying to make a quick buck turning out fake bourbon. They would just take grain alcohol and dye it and add flavorings and other unsavory chemicals to try to make it imitate that aging process. And that's what caused this conflict, was that the bourbon makers in Kentucky really resented the fact that these people outside of the region were giving their whiskey a bad name by turning out this sort of fake product. And that eventually culminated in the Bottle and Bond Act, which is 1897, I believe, and then the Pure Food and Drug Act a little less than 10 years later, which finally, you know, set that standard. The government finally, you know, got its act together and made a clear definition of what real bourbon was.
So now we get a legal definition for bourbon, and not too long after, bourbon and most other booze is illegal. How did Prohibition affect the bourbon industry?
Yeah, it's ironic, but it's true. And It's interesting. Prohibition, I think, on a cultural level, bourbon and, you know, the jazz age, the lost generation, they're very intertwined. So, bourbon definitely kind of put a fire and put some music in that age. But in terms of the effect it had on the industry, it was disastrous. And the only way that distilleries could stay in business was if they got a medicinal permit, because you could still get whiskey with a doctor's prescription. And very few, you know, only a handful of Kentucky distillers ever were able to get those permits. So quite a few distilleries went out of business. You had all manner of corruption and organized crime that was trying to get their hands on these sort of government-controlled stores of whiskey and get it up to speakeasies. And it was just kind of a nasty time. And it really took the whiskey industry, the bourbon industry, a long time to recover. Because even what happened was when Prohibition was lifted, it still, they hadn't been making whiskey in over a decade, really. So you didn't have, you know, and whiskey has to sit in barrels to age, so there was no aged whiskey to sell. So they had to really figure out ways to start turning a profit, and you start getting lower quality bourbon. And that went right into the World War II shortly after, when the whiskey industry again had to quit making bourbon to help the war effort. So I think there was a really tough few decades right after right after Prohibition that put a real dent in the bourbon industry.
We've got these Kentucky bourbon companies. Jim Beam is one that pops to mind. You write that for the most part, they haven't been owned by people in Kentucky for a long time. Chicago investors, and this year, Japanese company taking over. Does that affect the bourbon that America is drinking?
Well, it's funny. I think it, you know, the bourbon industry, there's some truth behind it, but generally, you know, part of marketing is oftentimes projecting like a real authentic Americana heritage ideal, which is true in some ways, but also bourbon, just like America, has become a big corporate global enterprise. So, you know, it's quite a few of the, you know, distilleries are owned by larger conglomerates, international companies and whatnot. So, you know, it's a little bit of a myth that bourbon is this kind of old-timey, you know, log cabin and racehorse type thing. It's a modern big business.
I just wanted to ask before we're done, at the other end of the spectrum, we've got a micro distillery movement making lots of vodkas and gins and things like that. Is it harder to break into bourbon because of the aging issue?
Well, actually it is. I mean, that's what I find especially fascinating about the bourbon landscape at the moment, is you have these traditional big distilleries, but then there's this whole new batch of small craft distilleries popping up. And it is true that it's tough to break into, specifically because you have to wait so long to start turning a profit. And that's why many smaller craft distilleries that make bourbon, oftentimes they start out making an unaged spirit like vodka or gin, you know, to start turning money while their first batch is aging, or in some cases other tricks like using smaller barrels, which tend to age the whiskey a little quicker, or buying, you know, aged spirits from other distilleries and blending them themselves. You know, there's certain things they can do, but it definitely is hard.
Dane, got to ask, how do you take your bourbon?
I like it neat. I like a neat glass of bourbon. I'm not too picky, but, you know, I won't turn down the good stuff.
I go neat usually, or it makes a fine Manhattan. Do you have a brand or two that you're recommending lately?
You always hear about Pappy Van Winkle, and it's great stuff if you can find it and afford it, which I oftentimes have trouble with both. But, yeah, I there's a lot of good stuff out there. Blanton's I like, Booker's, Weller. It's, you know, there's a ton of good stuff out there. And, you know, really you drink what you like. So if you enjoy it, I say drink it.
Dane, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Dane Hucklebridge. His new book is Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. And I ain't had enough. Need me a triple shot of that stuff. Gonna get drunk, won't you listen right here. We've all done a lot of learning in our lives, in school, on the job, or maybe in a hobby or sports activity. But one thing we may not have learned very well is how to learn. Our next guests say we make a lot of mistakes and have a lot of misconceptions when it comes to learning. The good news, they share some science that points toward better, smarter ways to learn. Their new book is Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. Two of the authors are with us. Peter Brown is a fiction and nonfiction author. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And Mark McDaniel is professor of psychology and director of the Center for Integrative Research on Cognition, Learning, and Education at Washington University. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, and Mark, let's start with a real basic question. What does it mean to have really learned something?
What does it mean to really learn something? Well, that's a complex question, Rob. but I think it means an array of things. I think it means that you can retain that information over a long period of time. I think it means that you can apply that information in new contexts. I think it means that you can display transfer of that information so that you can generalize and you can make inferences and you can reason with that information. So I think it means all of those things. And I think that's why learning is a tough challenge.
Let's start with now with what a lot of us do to learn. We cram. Maybe we read and reread the material until it sinks in. Peter, does that work?
Any kind of reading, rereading a material that you do over and over again feels like it works because you become very familiar with the text. You get an illusion of mastering it. But it has two problems with it. One is that you aren't really articulating the underlying ideas or connecting them to what you know or explaining them in your own words. And that kind of learning, typical of cramming, goes away very quickly. It doesn't transfer into long-term memory. And so it might help you the next morning in an exam, but if you take an exam a month down the road, it'll be gone.
Well, Mark, in the book, you illustrate this point with a real important example, somebody learning how to fly a plane. How did the cramming approach work, and what worked better?
How did the cramming? Well, I'm going to turn that over to Peter.
Oh, okay.
Bob,
Peter, go for it.
Peter was intimately involved with interviewing the pilot.
Oh, okay. Go for it, Peter.
Right. The basic difference here, two different ways in which this particular jet pilot was trained. One was by sitting through 10-hour days looking at PowerPoint presentations on principles of flight and the various aspects of his plane. The other way he was trained was in a flight simulator in which he had to recall from memory unexpectedly the different kinds of maneuvers he had to make in the cockpit. If, for example, his gas line froze up, his fuel line, or if he lost oxygen, any number of things, if he had an engine fire, he had to instantly recall the different switches he would turn and the maneuvers he would make before he even pulled out his manual. He had to stabilize the aircraft. Those are two different ways of learning. The PowerPoint presentations are not very effective, but the pulling something out of memory and applying it, doing it, which is difficult, as a way of deepening the learning, strengthening the pathways to that learning, and making it more likely you're going to be able to do it later when it's unexpected and you need to bring it out.
Mark, why does it work that way? Why is practicing retrieving information more effective than just seeing the information again and again?
Well, Rob, there are different views on that. So one idea would be that in practicing retrieving information, you're actually strengthening the roots to getting that information out of long-term memory. And in strengthening those roots or pathways, then these become more robust and they're less brittle. You can get that information out more quickly and it's more durable. Another idea that's fairly provocative, but there's evidence being accumulated for this, is that when you retrieve some information, then information then becomes it becomes labile again, and so there's a chance for that information to consolidate and amplify and become elaborated. And that's a pretty exciting idea, and there's some evidence being accumulated now in neuroscience for that idea. A third idea, Rob, is that in retrieving, what you're doing is you're elaborating on the information. You're forming new connections. You're forming new links that then make that information more interrelated with all of your prior knowledge, and that, again, makes that information more accessible later on when you need it. Probably all of these things are involved, but there's still a great deal of work on trying to understand why it is that retrieval is better than restudy.
So instead of just tucking it away in your brain closet, you're, I guess, wiring it into the brain's electrical system, if I can do a household
metaphor.
Well,
that's the idea, is that it produces, again, this is under exploration, but it produces changes in the neurons. And these changes become more permanent and more robust, and thus that information is more durable. And the idea is that retrieval does a better job of that than just rereading.
Now, Rob, I have a simple metaphor for this process. I picked it up from a professor who's been following the research and how she describes it to her students. She stopped lecturing and asked a question on the topic, and the students turned to their notes, and she says, close your books and think about it. Imagine your brain is a forest. The answer is in there somewhere, and the more times that you go find it, the stronger the path to that information becomes. And eventually, you begin to learn what's around it, the things that are connected to it. So that metaphor, for me, helps a lot to understand why recalling it from memory is far more effective than reviewing text or listening to a video on something to try to burn it in. Pulling it out makes it stronger than trying to burn it in.
Well, and Peter, that makes me think of something else that you guys point toward. Opening up the notes is the easy way to learn it. Struggling around remembers the hard way, and that's good. The hard way helps us learn better a lot of the time.
Effort is good. Effortful learning, learning where you struggle a little bit, is good. And in fact, the research is unequivocal that if you are practicing retrieving information or knowledge, you're quizzing yourself, say with flashcards or taking some kind of a quiz that you construct or found at the back of a chapter, it's better if you wait a while before you do it again so that you get a little rusty, because the increased effort to recall it actually strengthens the learning and the memory of the learning. So doing it over and over again isn't so useful. It really leans on short-term memory. Letting some space go and a little forgetting happen, which makes it harder, builds the long-term retention.
And Mark, I've heard this suggested as a strategy teachers can adopt, professors can adopt, using quizzes and tests, not to evaluate the students, but help them remember the information as a tool of learning instead of a tool of evaluation.
Yes, that's exactly correct, Rob. And we've done some experiments in the middle school and high school and at the university in which we manipulate whether or not the students are getting quizzes on certain information or whether they're presented that information for restudy. And time again, we find that the quizzing is producing better performance on the exams that students are taking for their grades than does presenting the information for restudy. So that's exactly right. Teachers, I think, now are a little hesitant to place more testing in their classrooms, and that may be well-intentioned with the thinking that students have too many tests. But we're thinking about tests as learning opportunities or learning devices, and positioned in the classroom that way, we think they make a lot of sense. And instructors who have started to change their classroom so that they have more quizzing are finding great positive benefits for their students. The other thing, Rob, is that we find that it lessens students' anxiety. Their self-reported anxiety about taking the exams actually lessons after they've had practice with some quizzes for learning.
We're talking to Peter Brown and Mark McDaniel. They are two of the co-authors of the new book, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about learning and making it stick. Our guests are Peter Brown and Mark McDaniel. Their new book is Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you're learning at school or on the job or on your own, what works for you and what doesn't? What doesn't make it stick? On the other side of things, if you're a teacher, a job trainer, what works for the people you are teaching or training? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to your calls. We've got Beth on the line in Superior. Hi there, Beth.
Hi. My question is, I used to, in my work, I was quite articulate and talked to a lot of people with good vocabulary and was able to articulate words and my thoughts. And now it seems I don't talk very much on my job. And when I do get in the position that I want to, talk, I just at a loss. I can't think of a word. It happens real often, or I can't say the big words that I used to say. It sounds kind of funny, but I'm just wondering, is that partly because I'm not practicing it anymore?
So you're feeling out of practice. Beth, thanks a lot for the call. So supposing that is the problem, that she's out of practice and wants to relearn how to be articulate, Mark, anything in your research that might help us be better talkers?
Well, I think that you placed your finger on it, which is that you have to maintain practice. So I think you have to find situations where you can try to use those words, or where you can practice interacting. Maybe you can even do this on your own. So you can have a news story, and maybe you say out loud to yourself a summary of the news story, or comments about the news story, or a book that you've been reading. Or sometimes book groups are very good for this. So meet in a weekly book group, and there you can practice discussing and using that vocabulary. I find the same thing, by the way, that over the summer when I'm not teaching, sometimes I get frustrated that sometimes I lose facility with articulating words that I think I know. But then once I get back in the classroom and after a couple classes, it seems to come back. So I think you've put your finger on it. You need to find ways to keep practicing.
All right, Beth, good luck, and find some ways to practice articulating ideas outside of the work setting and see if that helps. Go back to the phones now. We've got Kathy on the line in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi. So I'm wondering, since we know as we get older, we should keep our brains sharp by maybe learning a new language or learning a new skill, would you say the same holds true that the older we get, the more effort we should put into it? But that the more effort we are able to put into learning something will make our brains stay sharper.
Kathy, thanks for calling. Peter, do the same rules apply to our aging brains?
Well, Rob, I'm going to defer to Mark on this one. Mark has got a great book on this called Memory Fitness. Mark?
Oh, great. Okay.
Well, you're right. The same rules apply to aging brains. We've learned more and more that aging brains are plastic, which means they're able to grow and profit from experience. And what you mentioned is right on target. To keep challenging the aging brain, learn a new language. What we suggest in Memory Fitness is to take your everyday tasks and turn them into a bit of a challenge. So when you're cooking, instead of cooking the same thing over and over, think about adding new ingredients and testing how those new ingredients work for your meal. When you're gardening, instead of doing the routine gardening over and over, think about different ways to garden, testing new things, testing new plants, testing new watering schemes. So the idea is in every step of your daily life, avoid routine and try to challenge yourself with some new things so that you're thinking about it, inquiring about it, and looking at the results of things you've done. And absolutely, that is a good way to go about for keeping the aging brain active.
We're talking about learning with the authors of Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. If you found a busy signal when you tried to call in a few minutes ago, we've got an open line for you now at 800-642-1234 with your questions or maybe suggestions about learning. We'll take another call now. We've got Grace on the line in Verona. Grace, hi.
Howdy, howdy. Thanks for having this show.
Well, thank you.
I've been an educator in many different fields ever since I was pretty darn young, started tutoring young kids. I taught horseback riding lessons and worked with horses for a long time. Different people and different animals learn in different ways. You can have a class of 10 kids that you're teaching. You tell them all to keep their heels down. One kid, you got to tell them, pull your toes up. A lot of kids don't learn by the traditional classroom methods. And even though it's very difficult, you sometimes have to take the time to find a way to get through that to that kid. I teach adults very scientific information also, and I could have a class of 60 or 100 people and everybody be out there nodding, yeah, yeah, I get it, and you'd see one or two just looking confused as all get out.
Huh.
Pull them aside at the break and say, I get the feeling you're not understanding something here. Let's talk about it. Let's go over it. And you might just hit on that one little thing that'll make everything become clear to them.
Great, Grace. Thank you so much for that. So do individual learning styles matter, Mark?
Well, there are differences in learners. There's no doubt about it. And I think there are a whole host of differences. And some of the things that we've identified are that Some students are better able to take the information the teacher is giving them and glue it together in a coordinated structure. And other students aren't so good at that. Other students have difficulty understanding the main point, understanding the anchor points around which to organize the information. And so for those learners, sometimes, as the caller suggests, you may have to call them aside and try to get a feel for if they're selecting and identifying the appropriate anchor points around which to structure their understanding. And other differences have to do with how they're learning their concepts, whether they're focusing on some examples that are maybe not the main examples to the detriment of the main examples. So I think there are differences. I don't know if I'd call it a learning style difference, but I might call it a difference in terms of how they're organizing their knowledge and identifying the major ideas that make sense to them.
Grace, thanks a lot.
Of course, there's another important difference, which is all new learning has to build on prior knowledge. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has the same base of prior knowledge. And for some of those people who aren't getting it, there may be a gap between what's being taught and what they already know and understand. And making that point or filling in that gap is what turns the light bulb on for them.
Interesting. So it's the baseline knowledge as much as learning style. Back to the phones now. We've got Tom in Cedarburg. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on. I work on a lot of things at work, and I fix things. And I like to read about them first, like in a shop manual, blueprints, diagrams, step by step. I like to do that first and then actually look at the item, see it in person. And by looking at, the book previously or shop manual, I have a better idea of what I need to do and things work better for me.
Interesting, Tom. Thanks thanks for that call. And that reminds me of something I teased earlier, Peter. One strategy is to try to solve a problem before reading about it, before being taught how to solve it. How do those two play out?
Well, that's a very interesting finding from the empirical studies. That is that it might be something very simple. If you're asked to come up with, say, the name of the capital of Texas, and you search your brain, Dallas, Houston, and then someone tells you it's Austin, you're far more likely to remember the capital of Texas is Austin because you struggled with trying to put your finger on it than if you just sat down and someone said, we're going to go through the capitals of the states, the capital of Texas is Austin. That's true for complex learning, too. Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe at the University of Washington St. Louis, the physics department now assigns students to solve problems before they come to the class in which they're taught how to, because after struggling with it, they learn the solution better. Is that correct?
That's right. In our active physics now, students have to try to solve before they get to class. That's correct.
Amazing. Is that another case, Mark, where you're building that brain context as that scaffolding, so it's not just a free-floating piece of info?
Well, I think what it does is it relates to another good thing about retrieval practice, which is retrieval practice identifies for each learner what they don't know as well as what they do know. So I think in struggling with the problem, you identify for yourself where the steps are that are difficult and the things you don't quite understand, which allows you then to focus on that when you get instruction on it. Usually, we don't have those kinds of insights into what we don't know or what we do know, and when an instructor presents it to us in a well-organized fashion, we think that makes perfect sense. But then when we try to do it on our own, there are breakdowns, and I think trying to solve the problem first gives you a clue as to where your breakdowns might be, where your gaps might be.
You know, wrapping up, we've heard over and over again the legend that we only use 5% of our brain or something like that. I think that's been debunked repeatedly over the years. But it seems like we're not using this tool, this knowledge we have of how to learn better, how to learn. Do we have a lot of room for growth and improvement in our schools and our job training and elsewhere, Mark?
Rob, I definitely think we do. And that was one of the motivations for us writing the book, is that we feel there are many successful learners out there, and we illustrate those learners in the book, some of them, and by and large are using the techniques that the science of learning has shown to be effective. But there are many learners who are struggling, as you know, in on-the-job training in classrooms and so on, and we don't think that those learners are incapable. We just think that they're not studying in a smart way. We think they're studying in a way that's not effective. And so we think that it would be a huge benefit if more time were spent in schools helping students learn how to learn. I mean, we spend a lot of time on financial literacy. We spend a lot of time on developing the physical fitness of students. We spend a lot of time on everything except for helping the students learn.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Mark and Peter, Peter Brown and Mark McDaniel. Their new book is Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning.